You're listening to a 4x4 Radio Network podcast.
The Center Steer Podcast, a Land Rover podcast by Land Rover owners. Welcome to Center Steer episode number 31. It is November 1st, 2015. This is our October episode. For work reasons, I had to delay recording a week. So now we're recording on Sunday, November 1st. Joining me in the studio,
I'm Harold.
And I'm Dave Carroll.
On the Skypes, all the way from Vinyl Haven,
Jeff Aronson. Hi, everybody. And thanks for having me back on the air.
And also joining us from the island of Vermont,
Right on the Lake Champlain, Morgan.
Welcome, Morgan. Morgan, who we should always give a shout-out to, SeriesParts.com. You run SeriesParts.com.
Well, thank you.
And that is
that for, I do.
And what is that for?
Just helping people who own or are looking to own a Series Land Rover, helping them find a vehicle or a parts supplier or a garage to fix said Land Rover.
And the Center Steer Podcast gets no remuneration for that commercial. Just you join us on the
podcast. That's true.
You just join us on the podcast. I also like to remind you that we're proudly part of the 4x4 Radio Network. There are other parts of the network that cover. There's the 4x4 Radio Show. There's the ATV Show, and then there's the other show that Tony does. That's called the Jeep Talk. So. That's the only time you'll hear that word mentioned on the podcast.
Isn't there a Muddy Microphone also?
That's Muddy Microphone is the ATV one. Thanks for reminding me.
Right, yeah.
Yes, yes. And I believe there's a – I have heard that if you're a Nissan person, there's going to be a Nissan-related podcast coming up shortly. So it's supposed to join the network. So also want to thank everybody out on the Twitters and the Facebooks who have liked us, and I appreciate that. I should also ask you to go out to iTunes and give us a review, and maybe it'll push us up in the rankings. I'm not sure what that exactly will do, but it's something you're supposed to do, especially for a podcast. So go out and do it.
It won't be fattening my paycheck, that's for sure.
It's not going to fatten anybody's paycheck. There's no paychecks here. No, not at all. So. All right, so let's get into the show. First up is the news, and you know, we talk about sales periodically, and JLR had released sales figures for September, and JLR worldwide sold 37,240 vehicles. That's a 1% year-on-year drop from compared to September of last year. However, Discovery Sport is selling briskly, and it has outsold the Freelander by 30%. You aren't going to make a comment now?
I'm choosing which Freelander joke to insert here.
The Range Rover sales were up 6%. Range Rover Sport was up 11%. The interesting thing is I think that sales in the UK, Europe, and North America are doing very well, whereas China is kind of in a depressed state. Their sales there are down 29%. So, but things are going well.
I'm sure land wind sales are doing really well over there.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. So
much for the great savior market.
Well, they have their ups and downs too, right? Well,
there would be that.
There would be that. So putting two of our favorite things together, Land Rovers and diesel engines, you know, there's the Volkswagen has its diesel problem here with its emissions problem. And however, Land Rover North America CEO came out to say that they remain bullish on diesels in the U.S. Quote, there have been that has been our strategy and it is not changing. We have to deal with the situation as they arrive. We are confident of diesels, to which they have sold 330 diesels in September alone of the Range Rover and the Range Rover Sport here in the U.S. So I think it's a good number.
It's 11 a day.
Yes.
May I insert an anecdotal experience? When the Range Rover diesel was announced, I contacted the one dealer here in the state of Maine and was told on a Friday, you're in luck, they've just arrived.
Ooh.
We have one Range Rover full size, one Range Rover Sport. And I said, great, I have to come off the island the following Wednesday. Would it be possible to get a test drive? And they said, absolutely, if they're still here. On Saturday, the full-size Range Rover was sold. I got an email message from one of the sales guides there. So on Monday, the soonest that I could leave the island, I drove 100 miles to Portland, Maine area, where I discovered that the Range Rover Sport had been spoken for, but as they were prepping it, they would allow me to take it out for a short test drive. This experience 2 weeks later was mimicked when I tried to test drive one at Land Rover Richmond, and one was sold off the floor while I was there. Now, nobody has, as you cited, John, nobody has very many of them, but they are lining them up, and the existing customer base is already so interested that they're buying them as they come in. In fact, I listened to one dealer also working to trade one with another dealer because of color choice of the prospective buyer. So they're rapidly leaving, and no dealer actually has enough of them so that you sort of have one to test drive or use as a demo.
Apparently you don't have to test drive them. They'll sell them anyway.
Yeah. You'll see in the upcoming issue of Rover's Magazine, we have a full article on the diesel, the TD6. And we have some driving impressions based on the two that I've been able to drive.
Nice.
And a list of experiences of dealers from around the country who have test driven the ones that were brought to their dealership as sales demos.
Can you give us
Land Rover North America?
Can you give us a preview of your overall thoughts? Did you like it?
Let me offer only this statistic. So because the magazine comes out next week in the mail.
No spoilers.
The key number is 440 foot-pounds of torque. Need I say more?
No, I think no.
Not to me. I get it.
No, not at all. That's great information. Actually, I think that goes to the point of they're going to, I think, sell very well, and that's good to hear. Also, that Land Rover's continuing with the diesels.
I'm just thinking that you know Jeff's had the experience of driving two of them. I think that makes him the most experienced Land Rover tester on the continent.
Outside of the Land Rover experience instructors, probably so. It is a remarkable vehicle. You won't know it's a diesel. Except at the very moment of startup, when the starter sound is different than that you hear of a conventional gasoline engine.
So we talked about this last month. Autoblog actually had tested the diesel, and the comment that stuck out with me on that was that when they walked around the vehicle, they could not hear the diesel running. Did you notice that?
No, you could certainly hear a different sound, but not an obtrusive sound. This isn't a Dodge Ram with a Cummins engine. It's not even a Volkswagen TDI. It really is a very well insulated engine, and I'll leave it for the article just to note that there were a number of structural changes that were done to the Range Rover and Range Rover Sport models with the diesel to further insulate the sound.
Nice.
It's very impressive.
Good. Well, they're going to expand that to the Discovery and the Evox, and they're talking about 20-30% improvement in fuel economy.
Well, when you realize that it will also be likely with the Ingenium engine, the newer 2-liter engine that they're bringing over for the smaller models, it's going to be very impressive. That's the one, John, that's going in the Jaguar that you mentioned also.
Correct. Yeah, they're going to put it – actually, I'm glad you said that. Good segue. They're going to put it into the XJ and the XF.
And the F-Type, that crossover that they're introducing, its base engine will be that Ingenium diesel engine.
Not surprised there. It's a badge-engineered Evoque after all.
Right. Yep.
All right. So moving on in the news, this is related to the diesels. I found this interesting, another Autoblog article on Volkswagen. The Volkswagen fix would have cost $335 per vehicle. So I'll have a link to the article, but I think the salient point that I found from here is Volkswagen cost controllers wouldn't approve the AdBlue solution because it would add $335 to the cost of the vehicle. So apparently, you know, all the other things going on, it sounds like they knew about it for a long time, and it was, you know, all for all of $400.
Can I interject just a thought here? In the world of large automotive corporate politics, that alone wouldn't have vetoed it, because you could have created option packages that would have forced the base price down. The underlying question still remains, where in the engineering and calibration sections or departments of Volkswagen did somebody sign off on a vehicle whose software configurations mm-hmm. knowingly didn't meet yep. EU or American emission standards? Well, I understand the debate, and if I were in the engineering division, I would try and blame the cost accountants also.
Yeah,
but
yes.
at some point, that was signed off on. As you all know, if you've seen a base model, again, you'll see it in the upcoming issue of the magazine. If you've seen a base model, say Discovery Sport, you realize that some of the features that you presumed might be there are absent in the absolute base model. That's a way that you create that relatively comfortable looking base price. Mm-hmm. So there were options that were available to Volkswagen, I contend, in lieu of that engineering solution that was at least cost accounted and determined to be unaffordable. But the larger question still remains that what is possibly appropriate from an accounting perspective of having to recall upwards of 11 million vehicles worldwide?
Yeah, it's going to cost them a fortune.
It's certainly going to cost them more than $400 a vehicle now.
Yeah. A little bit.
Yeah. But to your point, Jeff, and this article even mentions those things where there was a lot of pointing back and forth on who did what. There's certainly sign-offs. And one thing, the article actually starts off by saying that Bosch, who created the emissions management software, had told, at least according to this article, told Volkswagen, you can't use this. It is illegal in the United States. And they went ahead anyway. So there's obviously more to come. But
well, obviously Bosch had to have known about it. They wrote the software, but this is proof, if you will.
According to the article, yes. Yeah. Right, yeah. Don't want to get ourselves into any other troubles.
Well, yeah. It'll come out in the investigation, I'm sure, but yes. It's just more weight to the idea that Bosch had to know about it.
Right.
And John, if I could interject here, the moment that hit the fan was the time concurrent when I was composing the diesel story for the magazine. We were doing the final drafts of it, including a long interview over in the UK that I had with the head of the diesel calibration for Land Rover. And I asked Land Rover North America, did they wish to have a statement for the magazine related to the Volkswagen situation? And I received sort of two types of comments. One was an informal, we don't want anything to even be associated with that debacle.
Yeah.
And then secondly was just a formal announcement that Land Rover simply doesn't have a defeat device of any sort, software or hardware built into the vehicle.
I have a little bit of a sidebar to this issue. It's sort of a tangent from here, but it ties back in. A number of months back, we had a discussion about the possibility that it would become illegal to work on your cars. And there was an article about the automotive manufacturer seeking protection under the
DMCA.
Patent infringement.
Also the DMCA because of the coding. But that's fine.
Right. The trademark office has decided that it is not illegal for end users to have access to the software to do these things, to modify and or diagnose their vehicles, which is a good thing. But the where I'm going with this is that the articles I was reading, a couple of the trade associations have chimed in that the one thing that might help to justify this is now it's analysts are able to look at the software and perhaps even detect the wrongdoings of manufacturers more readily.
This would give credence to allowing you to work on your vehicle or check
right.
the software. Yeah, I still think there is a avenue that they're pursuing though down the DMCA, which is on the coding side. Like it's our IP, you can't use it, you can't access it. I think they're still trying down that path. But I think I do agree though that this VW issue may help to stop those efforts.
Right, and it should be also pointed out that actually this this change to their policy has a one-year grace period for all the various government agencies to chime in and offer their concerns.
Well, specifically for modifying software on cars, tractors, heavy equipment, and the like, there's that one-year grace period. I know that there are some changes for, like, phones and tablets and smart TVs and stuff like that that go into effect immediately.
Right. And the interesting thing is the exception does not apply to service providers. People you pay to work on your vehicles for you will not have the same rights as an individual will, as it's written
Correct.
Now.
And it excludes some things like boats and who knows.
Boats?
Yeah, there's lots of weird things in it. Mind you, the professional providers still have the option to purchase a license and all that sort of thing down authorized channels. So it's not like you know it will be illegal for people to get paid to work on your car.
I'm just going to have all of my discos waterproofed and declared to be boats going forward.
There's a good idea. There we go. There's your answer.
I like the idea of just uncomputerizing them.
Yeah. Go out and buy a Defender. Moving on, in Land Rover land, the 2017 Disco has been seen out on public roads in the camo livery, which is that weird paint they do.
That is some wild-ass flower power camouflage there.
Yeah, they do the big camo stuff. But it's been seen out in the wild, it looks like in the UK or at least in Europe. So the new Disco 5, and hopefully the name will actually be called Disco here in the U.S., and they'll finally drop the damn LR4 business. It's coming in 2017, and it looks more and more like all the other families look like. It has that kind of, it's less boxy than it used to be, and the back end, I think, and even the article mentions, looks something like a Range Rover.
Camouflage kind of makes it look like a bread band to me, but...
And they're talking about it coming in, here it is, diesel, gas, and hybrid models. 330 horsepower, 3-liter supercharged V6 that's currently in the LR4. Looks like would probably continue, although they may also offer a 380 horsepower version. The diesel would be a 3-liter TDV6 that's currently sold, as we mentioned earlier, in the Range Rover and the Range Rover Sport. So there you go. It's coming. There's a new Disco 5 coming.
Would the hybrid be a gas electric or diesel electric?
I think it's gas electric. They have played with diesel electrics because we have heard about that, and they've mentioned diesel electrics, but I think this would be a gas electric.
I think they're a few years out on the diesel electric hybrid. They are playing with it, but I don't think they're there yet.
I think with all the newer diesels, they've gotten into the same problems now that they've had with the gas. Anyway, it's all too much electronics. So,
well, that's the modern world, Dave.
Yeah,
you know, that's everything's that way. You know,
doesn't mean we have to like it.
Some of it's good, some of it's bad. Just like when the cotton gin came into play, some of it's good, some of it's bad. It's always been that way with technology. All right. Well, I didn't think we'd go there. Moving on to Defender news in the. Slowly coming to the end of the Defender, Land Rover has set up a website called CelebrateDefender.com, and they want you to share your stories to celebrate the Defender, and you can explore some of the stories out there and check them out. Looks like around the world, all different kinds. They have categories for sand, bush, water, rock, urban, snow, and submit your story, and it could form the part of our monument to Africa's favorite vehicle.
Africa's favorite vehicle. We know some people who could help with that.
We do. We do. This is a good opportunity to mention our friends Graham and Louisa Bell, who have written their book, We Will Be Free, which I have an actual hard copy in my hands as I talk. You should go out and check that out on their website, A to A Expedition. Is that right? Is that what it is?
A2AExpedition.com. I'm reading it off the back of the book right now.
Excellent. It is A2AExpedition.com.
And the two is the numeral two.
Keep them on the road. Keep them in their Defender 130. And they should also, because I know they'll be listening to this, they should go out to CelebrateDefender.com and they should submit their story. I want to see them submit their
Let's
story.
Let's just hope there's not a character limit.
I guess you could put the book in there, right?
There you go. Add, just add insert, the book. Yeah. Upload the book.
Yep. Top Gear, the magazine, drove a Defender, the quote-unquote floating 90, on a Scottish loch. So if you, that's an interesting little article, bunch of pictures there. So if that interests you, you may want to go out and check that out.
So how did they do it, John? Pontoons or?
Yes, they use pontoons strapped to the side, and it's got a prop shaft, to a proper propeller. And they actually show the pictures, pretty good pictures.
Yeah, it looks like a civilian copy of the original military APGP.
Yeah, this looks like a modern late model 90. Yeah, there's the prop shaft.
Jeff, there you go. Your escape plan from the island.
Well,
maybe to the island.
That's what you need, Jeff.
There you go. You're no longer dependent upon the ferry schedules.
Yes.
That alone would make every bit of it worth it.
Do any
of you guys find it intriguing? This is sort of a what goes around comes around moment to me. I often receive gentle jibes from Brits involved with Land Rover or working for Land Rover over our general use of the term rovers here. Because of the Rover Car Company and its presence in England itself, Land Rover and Rover are not interchangeable in their conversation. Whereas we consider sort of all Land Rovers to where they may use the term Landies, we'll use the term Rovers. But now I find it humorous that the general phrase for all series 9110s and Defenders is Defender. So the Defender line really celebrates the days from the Series 1 to the last of these models. And Land Rover UK has been very forward about labeling them all Defenders. The interesting point to me is simply that within Land Rover enthusiast circles here, there's a distinction between the series models and the Defenders. We recognize the relationship between them, but there are separate forms, if you will, for series owners and Defender owners. And the range of Defender owners is often different than the range of those who own and operate series trucks. They're commingled in the UK, where we receive a great deal of grief, gentle grief, I will add, for commingling the term Rover to all Land Rover and Range Rover products.
Well, I do that as a way to show the heritage, and given that Land Rover was a model of Rover at the time it was conceived, and so I like to honor that heritage.
I do too. I consider them to be one and the same. But it's probably simply the way in which the Defender was reintroduced to the U.S. market after that 20-something year absence of a Land Rover, proper Land Rover, if you will, in the U.S. market, whereas it never really left the U.K. market. It's just a difference, and you see the impact when you see who are series enthusiasts and who are Defender enthusiasts.
Well, I think in terms of that issue, the one difference is that over there, they're just old trucks, and whereas here, if you want a Defender outside of the 2000 that were sold here at expensive prices, your option is to import one, which sort of puts you into a different league of enthusiasts than the guy that's got an old leaf-sprung series. So I think there's a class distinction involved, and if you really want to pick nits, you can't call any coil-sprung Rover made prior to 1990 a Defender, but people do.
That's right.
But, I mean, I make the distinction at the suspension. If it's leaf-sprung, it's a series. If it's coil-sprung, it's a Defender.
And not to mention all my friends who think I drive a Range Rover.
Well, that's just their own defective problem.
Well, exactly. But it goes to Jeff's point about it's only the enthusiast, I think, that thinks about this, the details and geek out on it. Really, because that's what we're doing here. We're geeking out on this stuff, and we're very specific about what this is and what that is and what this is. But for the average person, they think I drive a Range Rover.
Well, they don't get it. They're never going to get it.
Right, just as there's things we don't get. And
can we take our anoraks off now?
Sure. Continuing with the sad Defender news, redundancy process has begun on the Defender line, and they have offered, it looks like they've offered redundancy to up to the 450 staff that are working on the line, voluntary redundancy. Pretty much that's all that is in with this article, but so I just indicate that It's happening. But, it's coming.
You know, if they need to get rid of some excess tooling, I'd be glad to help them out.
You pick it, you pull it or something. I'm sure something if you went like over that. There. Yeah, right.
I would have to think that all of that stuff's going to go over to their Heritage Parts group.
Well, you'd think.
Yeah. Along the lines of various farewell drives, the newspaper, The Telegraph out of the UK, did also a final drive. And this article, though, is not a glowing, this is a wonderful thing, I wish it wasn't going away. You know, Andrew English, oddly enough, who wrote this article, was like, yeah, it's gone, thanks, good riddance, we'll see you. You know, the ride's horrible, the steering's vague, you know, the inside is from the 1970s and the 60s and the 50s, and you know, he's not a fan.
To contrast that with the Richard Hammond-style glowing tribute where he talks about how wonderful it is because the interior is from the 60s and because the ride is horrible and the steering is vague.
Exactly. You want to see the other side.
It's all that vagueness that makes it serviceable. I mean, that's what people fail to get.
It just makes it part of the experience. And if you don't get that, you don't need to.
Well, I have to think that this guy, honestly, there's probably some frustration because I'm sure that he's probably gotten tired of seeing all of these articles that say, oh, dear me, whatever shall we do? The Defender is gone. You know, we're a little less British today than we were yesterday.
He didn't mention that, to be clear. But
yeah. Or he's writing it this way because his wife won't let him get one.
Well, at the end of the article, I found this very interesting, and this may be a good point of discussion. He says, Land Rover has starved this vehicle of investment, ignored utility and military contracts, and allowed the Defender to stagnate.
The truth is that it all translates into maximizing profit.
Yes, but true, but also it shows that the Defender really has ended years ago, and that was their setting us up and getting us ready, and they were preparing to change it over. Yeah. I think if it was truly profit, though, I will say this, Dave, I think any other car company would have just stopped it and then waited 5 years and then brought something backwards. Yeah. I think they did a nice they're doing a nice transition. That's at least my take on that.
You know, John, when I saw that piece online, I rifled through my automotive magazine library here and found a 1979 Car and Driver, which road tested the very last year of the MG Midget. Don Sherman was the technical editor at the time, and Sherman's point was essentially good riddance, that it's about time that this little coal cart of a vehicle essentially left the road. And as Car and Driver did back then, there were always a section of comments from other road testers, David E. Davis, the editor, and others, who were more wistful about what it represented, and that as a, you know, as a starting point into the hardships that were inherent in sports cars at the time, this was the perfect entree, and you would have something less in this world without it. And I actually remembered that article and searched it out because that's just what the Telegraph article was essentially doing. There's no question but that Land Rover produced a vehicle whose driving patterns and habits and expectations no longer meant the contemporary auto market. But they also sold everyone that they could make. And as the closing of the Defender line would indicate, they're actually having trouble closing it down because they weren't able to meet all the orders in 2015. There's still, interestingly, a market for vehicles that make you sit up straight in them, that force you to like your companion because there's not much interior room, and force you to pay attention to the steering because it is vague. And that vagueness translates into great off-road capabilities. I'm not so certain that it's anything but a fear by the Telegraph, given its political leanings, that once again an important player in the British auto industry may have been missing a boat, as that industry diminishes in size, it's really left to Jaguar and Land Rover to be the prime producers of automobiles in the UK in any volume, based in the UK.
Good, indeed, good points.
Yeah, good. I would add to your story about the MG article, the best thing about an MG midget is how much more it makes you appreciate having a Triumph.
I never felt more comfortable than when I moved from a midget into my Spitfire.
There you go.
So continuing on our Defender Love Fest, although based on what we've just discussed, this is technically not about a Defender. This is about a Series 2. There is a...
Depends on which side of the pond you live on, apparently.
And which side of the other pond, too, because this is out of Australia. There is two mates are going to travel 3,000 miles across Australia in a 1961 Series 2. And they have a YouTube cinematic trailer, which we'll have a link to. That's all it says. Apparently, they're going to start, I think, November 29th. So we'll have a link to that, and you can check it out all of a minute and a half. So good luck to them.
Well, I think the interesting part is they're doing it in something as old and comparatively primitive as a Series 2 versus the people we know that have gone much farther in a coil-sprung Defender.
Indeed, and other things, too.
Which are arguably better suited for that.
Right. So
3,000 miles is a day trip to somebody who's already gone for 6 years and six continents and 133,000 miles or something like that.
True. Yeah. So check out Seriously Series Heading West on the YouTube, and I will have a link to it in our show notes. So as I said, good luck to those gentlemen.
So they're traversing east to west?
That's the yes, I believe they're going east to west.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
That's the news. We'll be back to talk with our special guest today, Jeff Aronson, to hear about his latest adventures.
October is a good time to give your vehicle some service, change all the fluids, and make sure it's ready for the coming winter. I do the same with my buildings. No fluid changes, of course, but I have to make sure the heat's working and everything is as weathertight as possible. I had a lot to do this year, so I tried to start early in September. Still, it's been a busy time. I kept encountering Murphy's Law. There's some debate regarding the actual origin of the idea, but the name is attributed to Captain Edward A. Murphy, Jr., an aerospace engineer who was conducting rocket sled experiments in California in the late 1940s. There are many variations, but the general idea is, if anything can go wrong, it will go wrong. In my case, it was nothing really major, but lots of little unexpected things, and everything took longer than I thought it should. Plus, I still had jobs to do for my customers. One such job was an ex-military 109 that was in for its annual service. There were a few minor repairs on the work list, so I started with those before moving on to the fluid maintenance. It was all going smoothly until it came time to change the oil in the gearbox. That's when it happened. Murphy's Law. Something could go wrong, so it did. The gearbox oil was silver and glittery, with chunks of metal in it. Now, shimmering metallic colors look great in paintwork, but mean disastrous things in oil. This gearbox was damaged and would have to come out. I just lay there for a few minutes in disbelief because this was not the first time this truck had failed a gearbox. In fact, it's happened so often that I've given them names. First was the gearbox it came with. I call it the Army Box because of the truck's military history. Whoever serviced it last must have thought that the number of smaller parts like shims and snap rings were just optional accessories that could be omitted to save time. By the time it reached my customer, it was JOA, junk on arrival. It still worked, but not well, and not for long. Next was the sloppy box. It was a used gearbox of unknown history that I had found and installed to get the truck back on the road quickly. It wasn't long before the deafening roar and refusal to stay in gear demonstrated the folly in blindly choosing this box. It was a sobering reminder that hasty decisions can be very risky. Either verify the history or disassemble and inspect. Otherwise, trouble is likely. I managed to get my hands on another gearbox, and this one had provenance. Not only did I personally know the original owner of the truck it came from, I'm also friends with the guy who had performed all the service on it ever since then. He'd even owned the truck for a while. He assured me it worked fine the last time he'd seen it, so it seemed like a no-brainer for an organ transplant into my customer's truck. It worked fine for several months until it inexplicably started misbehaving during a trail ride. It became increasingly hard to shift, and by the end of the trail, the decision was made to limp it the 14 miles back to my shop. At this point, fourth gear was unusable, By the time it reached the shop, there were only two gears left, second and second with overdrive. I decided to get started by draining the oil to see what might be in it. Would it be water, metal shavings, gear teeth? No, there were none of these things in the oil. In fact, there was no oil. None whatsoever. Not even a drop. I couldn't believe it, so I pulled the top cover for a better look inside. It was like a scene from the American Southwest. Dusty, brown, and dry. I half expected to find bits of Wile E. Coyote down in there somewhere. Fans of Notre Dame football would have appreciated all the pretty blue and gold colors, but they indicate to me that the rotating parts had reached temperatures close to 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. This was now the Blue Box, a particularly beautiful piece of junk. I would have suspected that someone neglected to check it, or just forgot to fill it, but I know it was full of oil the day before when it was in my shop for maintenance. I called my buddy, who is even more experienced with series rovers than I do, and after sharing my story, I asked him if he had ever heard of such a thing happening. I expected a negative, but he recalled a time many years ago when this same gearbox had mysteriously lost all its oil overnight after a longer-than-normal drive. Fortunately, it was caught immediately. Nothing seemed wrong, so it was refilled, and it never gave trouble again. Until it happened on my watch, this time with the most unfortunate timing. I now suspect a hairline crack or tiny casting flaw that opened when fully warm, allowing the oil, which is also very thin when warm, to leak out. I've seen this before in other components, and it can be hard to find. I know it's not my fault, but it's frustrating. It's Murphy's Law. This brings us to what is now the glitter box. I was tired of taking shortcuts with used boxes, so I would need to build one. I'd recently acquired an aborted 109 project, which included several boxes of transmission parts. I was able to assemble a nice gearbox entirely from the parts stash. What wasn't new was a good used part. This semi-new, rebuilt gearbox worked quite well for close to a year and a half, until the unthinkable happened. A 95-cent lock washer failed to do its job, and the special nut on the rear end of the main shaft came loose. This allowed excessive end thrust of the main shaft, which destroyed the needle bearing between the main and input shafts. But why? Was the washer defective? It's just a washer. Or had I done something wrong during assembly? It's hard to admit, but it is possible to make mistakes, even with lots of training and decades of experience. Perhaps it was just a fluke, something that just happened. Murphy's Law. Again, it's frustrating, and maybe even a bit embarrassing. Fortunately, I caught it early, before everything was destroyed. The main shaft, input shaft, and a few bearings were trashed, but everything else was still good. Most of it was still usable, once I got all the glitter washed out of it. So now, if you're keeping score, I'm about to install transmission number 5 in this particular 109. I'm calling this one Frankenbox, an undead reincarnation of a gearbox built from the best parts of all its predecessors. I'm hoping it's able to terrorize the villagers for many years to come. Every part, whether new or used, has been carefully gone through, measured and inspected, assembled and adjusted by the book, checked out twice, then checked again just to be sure. Plus, anything that could possibly come loose and cause trouble has been secured by a new washer and glued in place with thread-locking adhesive. I pity the poor bastard who has to take this thing apart someday. I really hope that poor bastard won't be me. I really hope this gearbox is ready and able to defy Murphy's Law.
Welcome back to the Center Steer Podcast number 31. Joining us today, live from the island of Vinyl Haven in Maine, is going to be Jeff Aronson. Jeff is the editor of Rovers Magazine. He's joined us a number of times on the podcast. I've officially designated you friend of the podcast. Hope that's okay,
Thank
Jeff.
You.
You're quite welcome.
Yes.
And so if you have not already, if you're in the Rover community and you do not get a subscription to Rovers Magazine, highly encourage you to do so. It is free, which is a great price. Great material, great content, and you can also get it online in PDF form. I prefer to receive mine in the old hard copy form. And if you ever have a sighting, you can submit it to the editor, which I believe is Jeff, you might get yourself a coveted Rovers Magazine mug.
If you haven't snagged them all by now.
I have 6 and I've stopped, okay? If one breaks, I will find another sighting. I have 6. I've stopped at 6. So, all right, Jeff, welcome. You have been to a couple interesting events over the past month or so, and you're going to talk to us about Mar, Yuhari, and a new event starting up in the West.
Yes, indeed. Thank you very much, John. At the beginning of October, the Rover owners of Virginia – have held the Mid-Atlantic Rally. And this has been going on for certainly since the mid-90s consecutively, and then sporadically right from the beginning of the club's founding in the 1970s. So it probably is the longest continuous Land Rover rally in the U.S. This year, for the third year in a row, they returned to the far western corner of Virginia, to the west of Blacksburg, Virginia, the home of Virginia Tech. And the hills of Giles County resounded this year with some 80 or so Land Rovers. The time of year is for this event has traditionally always been the first weekend in October, which coincides with hurricane season on the East Coast.
Yes, it does.
For those who like that kind of an outing, it's a good time.
Yeah. I was at two Mars in a row that had remnants of hurricanes dealing with
them. The monsoon Mars.
Good videos. Sorry, yeah. Jeff.
That's all right. And this year we missed the hurricane in Virginia. Sadly, the Carolinas got it. But we did get plenty of steady rain. And that did not really deter a lot of folks from showing and camping. The beautiful part of the event, beautiful parts of the event, I want to stress, are one that it is superbly organized. And I say that in the best sense of the word. There is something to do each day relative to your own interests in being a Land Rover enthusiast. If we wish to go do trails, these are all hillside trails by and large, carved out of a 700-acre farm owned by an enthusiast named Sam Moore and his son Stuart. They allow the Rover owners, members of Virginia, to come and carve new trails every year, and the trails are brilliantly done. They're challenging. There are some forest roads that go through that area that allow those who prefer a green lane type of trail to have a very good time and some beautiful scenery, some spectacular scenery. And at the same time, if Rovers North this year sponsored a trials course. So I spent 7 hours, almost 8 hours in the rain with the help of a couple of others, setting up a 5-segment trials course on a pasture land right at the foot of the camping area, which in turn was adjacent to the public road, the highway, and that's
the meaning one
stretch of Virginia. And I must say that as the dozens of Rovers tackled the course on a Saturday afternoon, plenty of vehicles going by slowed down to just watch the Rovers dip their way through this very challenging trials course that we were able to establish. The contours of the pasture with hills and mud and rock, the mud increasing with the amount of rain, couldn't have been better for a challenging and entertaining trials course. I've got to credit the folks who set up the trails in the woods. They were just terrific this year. Some great off-camber, some rock climbs, excellent forest trails. And again, because of the just general scenery in Giles County, you have these spectacular hillside vistas that pop out at you from every possible angle on the trail. And you can be in deep woods one moment and you come to a clearing area and you realize you're on a plateau at the top of a hillside, a ridge, looking out one direction towards West Virginia and one direction back into Virginia. Even in the drizzle, it was quite special. It was really very entertaining. Great bonfire at the campsite itself, lots of campers. Few folks came down from the Overland Expo weekend that had been going on at the same time and made an extra day of it at Mar. So really a terrific event and, as always, very, very well done. We had the added fun this year because of the weather. I flew down and had a Discovery Sport to use for the weekend. And I was so enamored of what that Discovery Sport would do on hilly, muddy trails with total street tires that I decided to include a section in the magazine of just how wondrous it was. I was following vehicles that looked like Dave Carroll's Discovery. Lifted, kitted out, and I was right behind and did not have any problem climbing despite my best efforts to get it stuck.
It's impressive.
It's an impressive vehicle just as it was. And then in turn, when we really needed to take seven very wet, muddy people to a restaurant in a nearby town, we actually really could accommodate seven people and a dog in that Rover. When I returned it to Land Rover Richmond, one of the sponsoring dealer for the event, the general manager came out and he took one look at it and he said, "This is fantastic. You really got it muddy." Behind him was the poor fellow whose job it was to detail the vehicle back.
Yeah, I bet he loved you.
He hated me.
gave you the look.
But I do want to give a lot of credit to the folks who came that weekend. It was a very entertaining weekend. Folks from as far away as New York State, Washington, D.C., folks came over from Tennessee.
Ontario, Quebec, because those folks used to come down in the old days.
And no, not this year. Okay. No, not this year.
What would you say attendance was? How many people?
There were 80 or so Land Rovers there. So
that's good.
You would get close to a couple hundred people.
Yeah.
And that's despite the weather forecasts, which were that the state of Virginia technically was in a state of emergency. So some folks called and Bob Steele, the president of Rove, and said, "Just can't come because I really need to stay by my house in case we need to evacuate those who live in the coastal areas of Virginia."
Right.
So they had more signed up. They just couldn't come. One entertaining moment came before the event formally started. I met up with the county administrator for that area, who frankly was quite thrilled that once again, MAR was being held in their county. It brought a lot of people to that part of Virginia who might not come otherwise. And he said to me, "We're having an emergency management meeting right after our little interview. Would it be possible for you to stay?" And I wondered why he invited me to do that. What I realized was, as they went through all the procedures they would undertake should a genuine emergency occur, that he was really asking, would there be 80 or so Land Rovers willing to serve as recovery vehicles
nice.
In an emergency? And I assured him that I could speak for the group quite confidently that there would be 80 Land Rovers and their drivers who would be thrilled to go do rescue work in their Land Rovers. And when I mentioned it to the group the next day, they all agreed.
Yeah, I never understood. We don't have that recovery thing that they do in the UK. I forget what it's called, but you know, the UK has a groups of people that will go out and do, you know, recovery if necessary. That doesn't seem to be a thing here.
We may be a more litigious society.
Yeah, you're probably right.
That's where I was going to go.
Yeah, you're probably right. So, good attendance. I've gone to that event for a number of years and always had a good time. I'm glad to hear that it's, back to what it used to be. You know, they had some rocky times there for a couple of years. So I'm sorry I missed it. Although, sounds like that was, you're right, it was at the same time as that Overland Expo here in the East Coast. I wonder if that affected attendance also.
Really, there were a few people who went, but Overland Expo was really oriented towards the trade and the overlanding. Mm. So if you're an overlander, like your folks Graham Bell and Luis and their family, Overland Expo is appealing because you're meeting up with other overlanders or you're seeing what's available for your vehicle. That it's really more of a trade show than it is an off-road event. You're not going to do any driving at Overland Expo.
So did they have the old things that they used to have at MAR? Did they have the auction and a group meal and
yes.
entertainment?
Yeah, and you know, it was another interesting, because of the weather, the company that was to provide the auction and Saturday night dinner tent called Rove to say, "Hey, we're going to back out because our insurance won't cover a hurricane."
Ugh.
And now a hurricane is predicted. So they quickly scrambled and they found that in that very county, about 5 or 6 miles from the campsite, was a former community school in the little town of Newport that now is used as a community center for the town of Newport. It had an old school cafeteria that was in perfect shape. They found a local restaurant to come and cater the meal. We probably had the best dinner that, and the most entertaining dinner that we've had at Mar, and I would predict that they may well use this opportunity in the future. The tenting is fun, but it's also fun to step out and to actually have a sit-down meal in an enclosed place where you're dry.
Yes.
And if you have to travel across... If you have to travel across roads to get there, it's a chance to shake some mud off.
And gas up again and pick up some beer and wine for the trip back to your campsite.
And you don't have to worry about getting lost.
It really worked out very well. The raffle was very well done. Dave Short, Fireman Short on the forums, is a hugely entertaining auctioneer. He did a great job again.
Good. Yeah,
and after it's over, you don't have to worry about getting lost going back. You just follow the thick line of mud.
Follow the mud. Follow the mud on the road, exactly.
So my favorite part, were there campfires that you went to visit in the evening?
You bet.
Yeah, that's my favorite. That's my favorite.
Some of the food and drink available at the campfires at the various camping sites along this hillside were really spectacular.
Yeah.
The guys do a wonderful job. There's also some great little breakfast restaurants if you're not cooking at your campsite in the morning, right nearby. This is really a very entertaining part of the state, and I can't recommend that event more highly because of its location. It really is an ideal mix of a beautiful vistas for the campsites and terrific vistas on the trails that are just across the way.
Did you say it's next to one of the state, like George Washington?
It is at the Jefferson National Forest.
Okay.
Yep, that's the one.
Thank you.
And it abuts it, and this farm that they used, actually some of the forest roads go back into the national forest. But the trails are all on private farm, and he couldn't be happier on this hillside farm to have Rove carving out new trails all the time.
Well, he gets to use them year-round. Of course he'd be happy.
That's right. He does.
Nice.
And he and his son each have wonderful series Land Rovers that they've put a lot of miles on, and yet the Rovers are kept in wonderful shape, and they really enjoy driving them.
Good deal. So if any of our listeners have been to Mar this year and they wish to share any of their experiences, we invite you on the show. Come on and talk about Mar and add to what Jeff has done. So I'm going to try to go next year. Sounds like it's a good opportunity to get back to Mar, because we used to go every year as a club, and that hasn't happened in the past couple of years.
Well, Mar sort of hit the dark ages there, and then everyone in the club sort of had life get in the way.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So you also, Jeff, you went down a little further south into North Carolina to Uhari, which is another event, right?
Right. The Old North State Club this is the 12th year of its Uhari event. The name comes from the National Forest about 50 miles or so east of Charlotte, North Carolina. And once again, this one is on national forest trails that are set up for off-roading, whether it's ATVs or motorcycles or off-road vehicles of any sort. The challenge for the event is, while the trails are terrific, they really were great fun, and they were certainly challenging in spots, many spots, you do not have exclusive use of the trails. So there were times when a large convoy of Land Rovers would be going up a hillside trail and a smaller convoy of Jeeps would be coming down the trail. And
who gets right of way?
Who gets right of way, and how you navigated that was an issue at times. Again, I need to commend the Old North State Club organizers for just the way this was set up. The campground was within a group campsite, a large one, that they were able to reserve for club participants. So it was all Land Rovers together with a handful of Jeeps present who are club members. Great turnout of range of vehicles, a range of experience from folks who had never done this before in new LR4s to some really wildly kitted out series Land Rovers. And a lot of vehicles, at least from my experience, trailered in. So they were purpose-built up Discovery 1s and 2s, some Range Rover classics that were trailered to the event just so they could be used for off-roading only. The event organizers really took the time to set up groups in relatively small numbers based on your interest and experience level so that we weren't all on the same trail at the same time with some of the backups that you get in at some of the larger events. There were certainly 100 plus, I believe there were 110 pre-registered Land Rovers for the Yuhari event. Not everybody was on the trail, certainly. I saw some vehicles just didn't leave. But they were so well done that you never felt overwhelmed on the trails, and yet you had a chance to watch a lot of vehicles do a lot of interesting things. Those are neat trails. Folks who've been to both events, I think, prefer the random nature of the Mar trails because you kind of know the Yuhari trails in advance. But again, this was so well organized that you had a real trail map that was accurate, that you could follow. So if you wish to go out on your own, you could do it.
That kind of takes the sport out of it, doesn't it?
It does to a degree, but I think it prevents problems where the National Forest people and organizing groups might say, you know what, I don't think we want this event at here this year. Right. So for that reason alone, you had a sense, particularly if you were new to it, that this was something you could be comfortable taking your newer vehicle on for the first time. Lots of kids at Yuhari. Lots of families showed up for camping for that weekend, big camping event. And because of the nature of the campsite, you could even bring a small caravan or a tenting arrangement. You had plenty of room for yourself. There were real showers, real bathrooms, amenities like that that you don't always get when you camp at Mar or similar events.
How many trucks were in attendance, do you estimate?
Oh, there were 110 easily.
Whoa. Okay.
Yeah,
that's bigger than Mar then.
That's impressive.
That was bigger than Mar. Yep. Yep. Oh, and the weather was frankly perfect. It was a little cool, that was all, but it stayed dry and sunny the whole time. It was trails that were you thought were relatively easy to navigate. You realize that if it had been wet, they would have been muddy and slippery and quite a challenge.
Yeah, I had my Freelander back in Yuhari back in the day, and I recall it being very rocky and kind of clay right underneath the surface. So I can imagine.
That's it.
Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah.
But I've got some great. We'll have both of the events will be in the winter 2016 issue of Rovers Magazine.
And that's not the upcoming issue. That's the one after.
Right. Yeah. Right. Our upcoming issue has a different, completely different set of stories this time, right?
When is the winter edition due? Is that like in January?
The winter edition comes out in February each year. The holiday issue is at the printer now and should be in people's hands within a week to 10 days.
Just in time for the shopping season.
Yes.
What a coincidence. What a surprise.
Good planning. Good planning.
And the winter issue hits the mailbox is about just in time for the winter romp, right?
It's just after the winter romp, usually. Yep.
But does not usually include coverage of the winter romp, right?
No. We put that in the spring issue.
Gotcha. Yep.
So you're also going to tell us about a new event taking place out in the West. I didn't catch the name.
You might have seen on various forums and the like an opportunity for a raffle victory for somebody of a Discovery One, which had been refurbished. And which a number of Land Rover parts companies, such as Rovers North and others, had provided parts for. And this was a fundraising opportunity for the Arizona Land Rover Club. This year, that club took on the responsibility of creating a Western Land Rover rally. And this was in the Sedona, Arizona area. My understanding is that different clubs in that southwestern part of the U.S. will each take on that event in future years. I know they had over 100 Land Rovers pre-registered, and Zach Griswold from Rovers North will provide photo coverage and an article of that for the winter issue. He said it was a terrific time. It was well done, very entertaining, spectacular off-roading in that open, gnarly, ravine shredded area of the Southwest. Very different than our winter and mud regions here in the East Coast.
Indeed. We had a gentleman join us at Amar years ago, and he had brought his LR3 from, and he had been in the West Coast for a number of years. And one comment from him was, this truck's too wide for the East Coast. It's too wide. I'll leave it at that. I don't want to say any more.
It was definitely a culture shock for him. It was a different sort of trailing.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. So you said Sedona, that's California, right?
Arizona.
No, Arizona. Sorry. I got my states wrong.
Now this is a competing event to the National Rally. Is that as I understand it?
No, it's not intended to compete with the National Rally, no. I think it was a recognition that the National Rally, for whatever reasons, just has a time of year that is less convenient for people, and the cost of that event, I think, was raising some questions for some participants. Just a chance, I think, to try something. You know, just as a thought here, in New England, I consider it a big deal if I go from Maine to Connecticut, but Texans drive that far for a gallon of milk. I think at times on the East Coast, I certainly ignore the vast distances that it takes to go between states in the West and Southwest.
Yeah, you can drive all day and not leave the state.
Of Texas, exactly.
Yeah. Have you been to the National Rally, Jeff?
I personally have not. I've only edited stories that others have sent.
Yeah.
I had a chance to go at one point to drive out with some folks from the East Coast, but simply couldn't take that time at that time of year.
Good deal. Well, so what's upcoming for you? Are you any events in the next couple months? Anything for the magazine? Or are you battening down the hatches on the island?
I personally am battening down the hatches. We actually have for this coming issue, for those of you who enjoy reading about Land Rovering in Africa, I have a terrific South Africa story in this issue that folks should get soon by a fellow from the Pacific Northwest who grew up in South Africa and returned home and took a 10-day or so trip in Land Rovers, including a Series 1 that accompanied him in regions of South Africa that just show how perfectly attuned those vehicles were for their daily use in a remoter place like Africa. It was really quite something. We've also got, though, if you're a Pacific Northwest fan, there were some terrific activities that went on this summer in Idaho and in the Pacific Northwest in Washington State, and we'll have those in the magazine as well. Commend the folks in Northern California from the Northern California Land Rover Club who put on a terrific event every summer up in the Sierras. And we have a great story about that and some terrific photos. Just encouraging everyone to, wherever you are, there's probably great scenery that your Land Rover can take you to see, and you should really experience it.
I could not agree more. That's absolutely correct. Then probably one of the best ways to see it is in a Land Rover.
It's the only way.
That's the only way.
It's either that or on foot.
Which, if you're in a Land Rover, there may be a joke there. Yeah, yeah. Well, thanks, Jeff. We appreciate you giving us an update on those
events.
Well,
thank you very much.
Yeah, absolutely. Always glad to have you on the
show. Now you may resume your hatch battening.
I think you got a new stove, didn't you, for the house? Was that last year?
Yes, I have a new wood stove. I will trumpet to those who are wood stove devotees. Company called Pacific Energy out of Canada, Western Canada. I am supremely happy with the early use of this stove and what it means for a perhaps warmer existence this winter. Terrific airtight stove.
Cool.
Very happy with it.
And how is your series truck running?
The QE1, bless its hat, is now running. It has been running well. It had not been stopping well. When I took off one set of rear brakes, I discovered the sort of goo that indicates either a leaky wheel cylinder and or a leaky hub seal, or a combination of the two. When I took off the other wheel, I discovered that I also had goop there. So fresh brakes on it allow it to stop better.
Stopping is optional, Jeff.
Stopping is optional, but it is helpful when children are involved and so on. I am actually readying the Tropic Top to go on the car for the winter. I've been running a soft top all year, and last winter ran my Exmoor top with a fume curtain as my winter runner, and it worked out quite well. I just don't want to subject the canvas top to another winter like we had last year, so I'm readying the windows tracks in the Safari top so that the window won't fall out again.
You ever thought about running the hard top with the fume curtain?
There would be nothing more effective in terms of keeping heat in the car. You can't, unfortunately, without stapling it to the roof, actually run it that way.
Well, that's just a little bit of fabrication away from happening, Jeff.
It could be. It could be. Right now, I'm gonna run it as I have in the past with the hard top. Last year was the first year of trying it that way. It worked, but I don't want to ruin that canvas top.
What are you running for a heater?
I have, when I bought the car, it came with a Kodiak heater that was the standard at that time for the U.S. models, particularly those in the Northeast. But back in 2003, it received the Rover's North Mount Mansfield heater,
okay,
which is really just a different core and blower motor.
It's a stock heater on steroids, as I recall.
It is, and it really does work. You actually can feel the heat in the vehicle.
You know, that 109 that I looked at yesterday that I told you did the recon, it had in the dash two of those cheap electric heaters.
Really?
They were attached. Yeah, the ones you buy for like $5.
These are a waste of time.
Yeah, they might put out heat eventually. Yeah. And it was certain,
whilst draining your battery and killing your alternator.
Completely, yes. And for those who maybe don't know, Jeff, your QE1 is your daily driver, right?
That is my daily driver. I've had it since 1991. Now I've been able to establish that it has over 550,000 miles on it. I have
That's a good an start.
Engine. Yeah, now she runs every day. I have an engine that is a Rover's North rebuild from 1995 that went in at about 180,000 miles. So that engine's been in the car since then. I have not even had the head off of the engine.
You've put 400,000 miles on your truck?
Yep.
Wow. I didn't think the island was that big.
It isn't that big alone. The truck is, some of my work takes me off island, and it's sure. gone on a lot of trips over the years. Yeah.
Well, plus, you got to remember, he hasn't had brakes for a while, so he just lets it run around the island. He just gets in it when he needs to and gets out when he needs to.
Maybe he used it to heat his house maybe in the past, too. And just
packed it indoors.
Good deal. Hey, thanks, Jeff. I appreciate you giving us the update and continued wonderfulness of the Rovers magazine. I do enjoy reading that, so. And now we're going to talk to our local correspondent, Dave. He's had been to a couple events, and he has some events coming up, and he's going to give us an update on his truck. You haven't been on the show in a while, so this is a good opportunity for you to let our listeners know what's happening to you in your world. So you've moved to a farm.
Yes.
And yes, you still have...
Where I can make extended use of my various Rovers.
And how big is the fleet these days?
Well, let's see. I'm down one. So we're down to three Discoveries. One is parts. One is probably on its way to being parts.
Oh, they're all parts eventually.
Well, yeah.
So
honestly, all of my Discoveries have probably they're closer to being done and gone than they are to.
How many on the road?
One.
One, and that's the blue one.
That is the blue one.
And you have, and so where have you been recently? I think you said you went to Robesonia.
Well, I was headed for the Robesonia trials, and about 4 hours before I needed to get in the truck and go, I decided that I couldn't trust my new cooling system enough to take it out on the turnpike and then hope to actually make it home. So I aborted that whole trip.
So tell us about Robesonia, though, for those who are not familiar with it. Where is it located?
Robesonia,
how many people are there?
Is in northeastern Pennsylvania, and it is their trials event is sponsored by the Rovers Club, and that is an acronym for something, and I couldn't.
That's different than Rove, which is the Virginia folks, right? Rovers is Rovers Owners of. I forget what Rovers stands for, too. I forget. Where are they out of? That's Philadelphia?
Yeah, eastern Pennsylvania.
Okay.
So, the Robesonia Trials is a relatively large event, small in participation, but they actually have typically a 10-stage trials course where you compete. And I found that trials is my niche.
Ooh.
I mean, I like going to events like Rovers on the Rocks, but trials is a lot of fun.
It's very technical, definitely.
Oh, without a doubt.
So for those who haven't been to a trials event, what takes place? Like, what happens? I assume this is a time-based and a score-based system?
It is not time-based. It is score-based. You start out with, on a single stage, there will be 10 checkpoints. And you have to pass your vehicle through each checkpoint. They're numbered from 10 down to 1. And by passing the vehicle through each checkpoint, you reduce the number of points that you take.
So the higher the points, the worse you are doing. And then you're reversing, you're trying to park, you're trying to climb a hill and make a turn.
If you reverse, you take whatever number of points you would be
shunned
at. Yes.
Known as a shunt.
They do allow a single shunt. I don't know. It's hard to describe.
So, but you're doing a number of technical things with the vehicle. So you're trying to climb and turn.
Yeah,
you're trying to go down
a
hill and turn. You're trying to back into
descend.
Things. Yes.
Yeah, and John and Dave, if I could interject one point that's important. Generally speaking, you're not allowed to stop and think.
Right.
So you actually need to be moving forward, or if it's a reversing course, reverse, as you go. You cannot stop or you lose. You are assessed the points at the slalom marker where the stop occurred.
Yes.
As I recall, you're not allowed multiple tries at the same stage either. You screw it up, you screw it up.
That's right.
Take your points and move on. Yeah. So that's Robesonia. Is there off-roading there also, or is it just a trials event?
No, it's just a trials event. It takes place on private property.
Do you camp, or is
you
this...
You do camp.
Okay.
Or you can camp.
There's also...
A lot of people are local to the event, so they don't stay.
Right.
But there are a few of us that do stay, and, a good time is had by all in general.
And you've participated. I know you've gone for the last couple of years.
I've gone probably 3 times now over the last 2 years or 3 years.
So did you fix your truck since you couldn't go this year?
Yes, I did. And I decided that I needed to more thoroughly dismantle the vehicle.
That sounds like you, Dave.
Because you've not dismantled it upon the trail enough, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've done some things that I guess are a little out of the norm for D2s, even off-road.
Really?
Dave, how many guys do you know that have punctured the top of their fuel tank?
None. None. One now, apparently you.
Yeah, yeah.
That takes some special skill, I have to admit.
We have to pause the podcast. How did that happen?
I don't know. I don't know. The conclave the year before last, I was standing there next to my truck, and I thought, I smell gasoline. Someone further up the trail must be having a problem. And I start looking around, and no, there's a stream of gasoline running out from underneath my truck. So,
and quick, light a match.
Well, no, I chased. There was a guy walking by with a cigar, and I chased him away.
So, what else? What other events are coming up, Dave?
So the big event here in the Northeast. Well, there are a couple of big events coming up. Typically, there's a Guy Fawkes event in New York.
Right.
That I have never been to, and I just know that it happens right around the beginning of November.
Are you familiar with it, Jeff?
Yes, I am. It's upstate New York, and there's an enthusiast. In fact, it should be coming up soon. Guy Fawkes Day is November 5th.
Right.
And it tries to coincide with that old British holiday. It is a highly entertaining event and has...
Would you put a mask on your truck? On your truck?
Of the upstate New York folks, some from come down from Canada. For the longest time, it was a very serious Land Rover-oriented event in terms of who attended, but it's not closed to anybody.
Yeah, I know.
But
the
it's one of these quiet, individual... I'm going to forget Howard's last name. But a guy named Howard puts it on every year.
Yeah. That's...
I'll find it, track it down, and put a link in the show notes then.
Yeah, I've heard it's a great event. Yeah. So...
And what? And then Rovers on the Rocks?
And then Rovers on the Rocks the weekend after next. Right. So I want to say the 12th, 13th.
13th or something 13th, like that.
13th, 14th, 15th.
Are you going?
Yes, I am. One way or another.
And so if you're a podcast listener and you find Dave, say hi to Dave.
Come and say hi.
Yeah, come and say hi. I should give you something to give to our listeners that show up. I don't have anything, but...
That's no, we'll come up with something.
Come with something. Give him a card. We have cards.
I'll part off my truck.
Yeah.
something will have fallen off by then. You can just hand it to them.
Oh, it won't have fallen off. It may have been rubbed off against a rock. Or
actually, listeners might have to give Dave a part. That would probably more what's happened.
Yeah, that's...
Hey, my truck goes out. My truck brings me home.
That's true.
That's all it really has to do.
There you go. And so what should listeners look for? You're going to be traveling in what? A blue D1, right?
A blue D2.
A blue D2. And this will, and it has a roof rack.
Yeah, it's got the SD rack, custom bumpers and sliders.
There you go.
Courtesy of Jag Speed.
Sitting across
from us. Which is also the source of the rack, as I recall.
Yeah.
I believe all external steel work on your truck came from the same source.
No. There's some Bearmock stuff. And
really?
Yeah.
We're going to have to talk, Dave.
Lucky 8 heavy-duty steering gear and things like that.
Is your family going this year?
You know, I don't know. I may wait until the last minute and decide based on the weather.
Understood.
I took Sydney, my 7-year-old, last year, and we had temperatures in the teens at night.
That's right. I remember you telling me about
and
that.
And she thought it was the greatest ever.
Yeah.
She loves camping.
Good for her.
And especially when things are ugly like that.
Yeah. She's a trooper.
Oh, she is.
She is. She's been on. I've camped with. Been in a camp. She's been there. She's great.
Yeah. She got to ride in the front seat last year.
Ooh.
So.
Anything else beyond Rovers on the Rocks? Anything else for you?
For the rest of this year, probably not.
And what about the Maine Winter Romp?
The next big thing for me will probably be the Maine Winter Romp, unless our local club decides to do a one day.
So how long does it take to get to the Maine Winter Romp?
It depends on what the conditions are while you're traveling.
And whether you have leaf springs or
what
not.
What if you're in a leaf spring truck?
It should be like 15,
start now.
15 or 16 hours.
Oh, okay.
That's a long time in something that primitive.
That's a 2-3-day drive. Yeah.
Well, I mean, Bill Fischel used to drive it all the
time. I know.
He must have a better spine than I.
Yeah. I've thought about it. I mean, you know.
It's
I'd
a
like
great
to
event.
I've heard.
Great.
But, you know, traveling in a 109 with a fume curtain, and, yeah, that would be the fume curtain. I highly recommend the fume curtain, Jeff.
I do, too.
Yes, absolutely.
Sure, worked very well.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, the Maine Winter Romp is a special event, yeah, without a doubt.
Well, we look forward to you coming back on the podcast, Dave, and giving us an update on what happened at these events and giving us that perspective.
Without a doubt.
Good deal. Thanks, Dave. Thanks for letting us know that. So that is our guest segment and updates on trail rides and adventure going out and about. If you yourself, listener, are out and about on a trail and you want to talk about it or give us a report, happy to have you on the show, even for a few minutes, to give us an update on what happened for you at that particular event. Always happy to hear about those events that are going on out there. And next up on the Sinister Podcast, number 31, you're not going to give me the XXX stuff, no?
No. You're not gonna Triple do that? X plus one just doesn't sound as sexy.
We are entering our heritage segment, and I'll turn it over to our heritage correspondent, because I can't think of a better word, Morgan, and he's going to talk about electrics this time, I believe.
That is true. Thank you very much. Specifically for series Land Rovers, the electrics are somewhat primitive, as you can imagine. With the wiring itself, there's actually a distinct advantage to British Land Rovers, but all British vehicles, that the color codes for the wiring was set by the British Standards Institution. So it is actually standard across all the vehicles. So you can go from an MG to a Land Rover to a Triumph and find, you know, the same wiring for brakes and lights and what have you. Makes things a lot easier.
It comes in handy when you're in the business of fixing them.
Yes, and, you know, a lot of the parts were interchangeable as well, being mostly Lucas. So that you can find parts across a lot of the different marks. But in terms of the wiring, I believe that the very early models of the series Land Rovers used a braided cloth insulation on the wire as well as a braided cloth wrap.
Yes.
For the wiring looms. It's a little hard to nail down exactly when they switched over to using the PVC insulation with the braided cloth wrap. I've seen some series ones with that. I've seen some Series 2s, some Series 2As. And then eventually by the time they got to the Series 3, they were using PVC insulation and a PVC wrap. And now I may need some correction here, but I believe that the British wiring, they didn't use a standard gauge that we think
not.
Of here in the U.S.
They counted conductors. You had
exactly.
A 7-conductor wire and a 14-conductor wire, et cetera.
Exactly. So we here consider a gauge to be the diameter of the wire, but they were counting gauges.
Means your American wire gauge strippers don't work quite the way they should when you're stripping the wire.
Exactly. And also, you know, generally you're used to, you know, considering the gauge for how much electricity can pass through a wire. That doesn't always, you know, work out the same either. And Land Rover traditionally uses bullet connectors. So those are a different crimp and connector than you would normally find over the counter here.
Yeah, and the fact that their bullet connectors are different from our bullet connectors. They're a different diameter. You can get bullet connectors here, but they don't work.
Right, exactly. I would highly suggest, in addition to companies like Rovers North, who do provide these parts, you can get the genuine parts from Rovers North and others. You can also go to britishwiring.com. They also have a lot of the parts and wires. You can get.
They can
full
build you a factory
harnesses.
Harness. Yeah, in fact, they can build you a custom harness. If you've made some changes to your vehicle, you can outline what you've done, and they can build you a harness to suit.
Exactly, they are an excellent resource,
and available in your choice of cloth or PVC overwrap.
Yes, definitely. You know, for those trying to be as original as possible or not as original as possible. and then, of course, you know, when it comes to wiring, you will hear the age-old debate of whether to solder, to crimp, or both. And if so, in what order? Everybody seems to have a different opinion on that. Usually, you know, obviously with the bullet connectors, you need to crimp them. Some people prefer to solder as well to keep, you know, contaminants from getting inside the wiring at the ends where you have crimped it or made other connections. And then some people prefer to do that before they crimp. Some people prefer to do that after they crimp. I don't know if you guys have any preferences.
I've kind of gone all different directions on it, and it's sort of what I think is going to work best in the particular situation.
Exactly.
And what I have to work with.
Yep. Yeah, so, you know, you'll hear lots of different opinions on that, and I think it's one of those things, do what works, what you can do at the time. And then, you know, that's most of the wiring itself. You know, Sirius Land Rovers originally were a positive earth or ground. And then in, I think it was around 68, they switched over to negative earth, which is what we're used to at this point for the standard. Electricity in a circuit, it flows from the positive terminal on the battery through your circuit and out to or back to the negative terminal on your battery. So
most electrical engineers will disagree with you on that point.
Oh, did I have that backwards?
Well, it technically does flow from the side with more electrons to the side with less electrons. But, yeah, most of the automotive service world tends to think of it in terms of positive to negative, but technically speaking, it's the other way around.
Right, and I always get a little confused. It's actually the reverse of how it works in physics, because the electrons flow negative to positive. But yeah, so when you're speaking with ground, that's referring to, you know, generally when you create the circuit, you're going from the battery to your circuits out through, you know, all of your switches and fuses and all of that. And then generally, to keep the wiring much simpler, you're grounding it out to body and chassis panels and having that return the current back to the battery. So with a positive ground, that you're having all of your positive connections ground out to the body and chassis work and return to the battery. With negative ground, you're having your negative connections ground out to the body and back to the battery. And there are some things to watch out for, which I'll get to later in terms of the ground. Obviously, not everything is designed to flow in both directions. That's polarity. So not that many Sirius Land Rovers have radios and stuff like that, but a lot of those accessories have specific polarities. And then, of course, you know, most of the Land Rovers are a 12-volt system. But as some of us here know, they did make 24-volt systems. Starting in the late 60s for the military, specifically for the FFRs, the fitted for radio models. Be on the lookout for that. If you have a vehicle with 24 volt, you'll need different accessories.
Yeah, I have a list of the parts you have to change if you ever need them.
Nice. And then, you know, one of those parts is the alternator.
Yes.
Exactly. So originally, Sirius Land Rovers came with a generator or a dynamo. And those are, I believe, are pretty much a DC brushed motor running. It's tuned specifically to produce electricity as opposed to produce motion from electricity. They don't produce quite as much voltage as an alternator does. And they generally produce electricity all the time. And they also need to be polarized. So that's another thing to watch out for, depending on positive or negative earth on your vehicle.
Yeah, it's not so much the generator as it is the voltage regulator in that case.
Right, yes.
And the alternators are not polarity specific, but the big difference in terms of output between the alternator and the generator is the alternator can do it at a much lower RPM, and that's why they were popular and gained popularity, I should say.
Yep, and they don't produce all the time, which is an advantage if you don't need the extra electricity at that time.
Right, they only produce when there's exciter current in the field.
Yep.
And the other interesting thing, if you're into making changes and doing things that not as the manufacturer intended, they can be made to produce in either direction of rotations. If you need to flip it around to make it fit under the hood, that's fine.
Right, definitely. And I don't believe the alternators were standard on series Land Rovers until around 1971, but they were an option in the mid-60s and later.
Yeah, as they were on all of the British makes. And it was the same alternator, too.
Nice. And
if I, Morgan? If
yeah,
I
absolutely. Could,
from experience, on my... on my Series 2A, my 66 2A, when I first got it, it came as a positive ground generator item. And I reversed the polarity deliberately because I wanted to put a CB radio in for off-roading. It was not difficult to reverse the polarity and to set it up that way. What I found was that in general, at about 30,000 to 40,000 miles of driving, the brushes would wear out on the generator, and you would have to take it off, put in new brushes, and put it back in the vehicle. It was not a particularly difficult job. It just had to be done more often. My experience with an alternator has been that a repair of an alternator usually requires it to be removed and requires somebody with a knowledge of diodes and soldering to do it correctly. It's almost easier at times to just swap the alternator out. They certainly last longer, and as was noted, they will produce recharging current at idle speed, which a generator generally doesn't.
And that's a very good point on the maintenance, because they are alternators can be lower maintenance. Generators are something that's more maintainable yourself, but those brushes are somewhat of a consumable part in DC.
Well, and the reason why the brushes don't wear out in an alternator is because the brushes don't carry the charging current.
Right.
The brushes in an alternator are only there to energize the field to produce output. Yeah. All the heavy current's carried by the stator on the outside.
Stator, yeah.
Right.
And I want to put a pitch in from your discussion of connectors and grounds and wiring in general. British vehicles don't have a great reputation in terms of electronic reliability. More often than not, I have found from my experience that that's because of the function of the age of the vehicle. When the vehicle continues to run like a series Land Rover or a Range Rover Classic or a Disco One, you assume that all the components within it must be in good shape because the vehicle's running. In actuality, there is a lifespan to any wiring and to the continuity available in any ground based on years of muck and corrosion and just brittleness that takes in on from the metallurgy of the wires. There's nothing like a fresh wiring harness, whether it's specific to the engine or the lights or a general wiring harness, to make a huge difference in your assumptions about electronic reliability of British automobiles, Land Rovers included. It makes all the difference in a series truck if you're doing something major to it, to just go ahead and get a new wiring harness in there. You just won't have the electronic issues that you assume you will.
And in the big picture, they're not that expensive.
Bingo.
Right, exactly. And it's one of those things where even if you go and inspect your wiring, you may think that you're seeing things are all fine, but by the time you go through to remove all the connections and replace them, when replacing the wiring harness, you find, oh, well, here's a bad ground here. Here's some corrosion there. I missed that. So it's just a nice point to, you know, you get to go through the entire system and clean up every little bit of it.
And it's easy to get corrosion up inside the wire where you can't see it. And right. You have chasing down these phantom problems and it's in the middle of the wire somewhere and you don't know it.
Absolutely. And, you know, you know, especially with grounds, a bad ground is a very common problem. You know, most vehicles, it's due to rust. But with Land Rovers, there are also points where you are grounded through a point that's also, you know, contacting the Burma Bright body panels. And though that process of corrosion of the Burma Bright is actually expedited by electricity when there are contaminants.
It's the electroplating process.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
In reverse.
Right. Definitely. So, you know, it's always good to clean that up, and that will prevent your panels from being eaten away as quickly as well.
If I could put a pitch in, Morgan, for your work and for your shop experiences on the other side, I had a time with the QE1 where it would idle okay, and the moment you tried to accelerate, it would break down as if I had a bad coil or a bad coil wire. When I actually opened up the distributor to take a closer look, I found I had a terrible wobble in the distributor shaft, and that was the reason that the points weren't opening and closing properly, and the car was misfiring. Not having any part available in southern Maine at the time, I stopped at a fellow who runs a British sports car restoration shop, and there in the back, tucked away in his junkyard, was a Sunbeam Imp. Remember those?
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
And which had a Lucas distributor. And we looked at it. We looked at mine. They were essentially identical, certainly in length and the keyway. And that went in my vehicle and got me where I needed to go until I could get a new distributor put in.
Well, I think Lucas only made 3 distributors for 4 cylinders.
There's only so many ways you can do it.
Right.
But how many worked?
Well, they all worked equally well.
That's not saying much.
And speaking of, you know, grounding and body panels and stuff, that brings us to the point of fuses, of which most series Land Rovers only had one.
Or one that did anything.
The fuse.
Or one that did anything, yes. And
Two?
There's two, but only one does anything.
One handles everything but one item. The other one handles that one item. Yeah.
Assuming you have a dome light in your vehicle, you have two fuses.
Yes. So the series 1 through 2 and 2A.
I don't understand why that guy from the Telegraph didn't like the Defender. I don't understand.
Well, the Defender went the other way. They overfused the hell out of stuff they didn't need to. But anyway.
You know, probably from experience with the previous models.
Yeah.
But yes, you have to be very careful. A short in your wiring can burn out most of the wiring harness or burn down your entire vehicle. I have seen that a few times. And one fuse for that entire system is really not very appropriate. By the time they got to the Series 3, there were actually 3 fuses. Should have been a lot more.
Well, the one thing I can say for the single fuse system is it makes a really good poor man's theft protection.
Yeah, because battery cutoff switches are so complicated.
Well, fuse is already there. Just give it a yank. That doesn't cost you a thing.
Essentially a battery cutoff.
Yeah, it is.
It's true. And, you know, along with the rest of the wiring, British fuses are rated differently than American fuses, so keep an eye out for that. As you can imagine, there are some of the upgrade options we've discussed. There are more, obviously, the converting from positive to negative earth is a common one, especially if you want to run accessories. There are some people who upgrade to solid-state voltage regulators. They're just a little more modern. They're available out there if you really want to do that. Obviously, alternators are also a common upgrade. One of the most common is probably the Delco 10SI series. also 12 SIs and some of those. If you want to get one of those, there are a bunch of adapter brackets out there. You can put most models in there, though. Very common is to set up a full fuse box with a lot more fuses to make sure your wiring is safer. An extremely common one and a very intelligent upgrade to make is adding relays, especially for your headlights. Yep,
absolutely.
Because all of that power for your headlights is actually going through, you know, in the Series 3, it's the steering column and the switch, the indicator switch. In the earlier models, it's still going through the switch. A relay basically is using a lower voltage to control an electromagnet to throw the bigger switch for the actual current flow.
Yeah. And the nice thing about that is your delicate Lucas switch is only passing signal voltage at that point, or signal amperage, I should say, and they last virtually forever once you take that load out of them.
Right, exactly.
And a relay is $5. When it wears out, you just unplug it, put a new one in, and you're fixed.
Right, and you know, you get some other nice side effects from that as well. They're not really side effects, they're bonuses. Like you actually will get slightly brighter headlights because you can actually pass that higher voltage through there. You can even then go and install upgrades like halogen headlamps or LED headlamps. You can also do some other lighting upgrades like LED bulbs for your gauge clusters. Those are pretty easy to find, with the exception of the charge bulb. That one, the bulb actually acts as a resistor, so don't swap that one out. I think that's pretty much all I had on my short list of upgrades. Again, I would highly suggest checking out BritishWiring.com. Obviously, Terry Ann Wakeman's website, expeditionlandrover.info. She has a lot of documentation there on wiring.
Yeah, I think if you own a series truck, you need to have Terry Ann's site bookmarked.
Absolutely.
It's just that simple.
Yep, I agree. There's quite a bit in lrfac.org, the Land Rover FAC. That has quite a bit on electrics as well. And I think that's pretty much all I have.
I want to throw in just a thought for series Land Rover owners particularly. You mentioned fuses, and you're absolutely right about the British fuse ratings that are different and have that built-in overload for the initial surge of amperage.
Right.
The other part that I have come across, and this has happened to me twice over the decades that I've used my series Rover, the fuse box abuts up against the firewall or the bulkhead. And I have found myself fooled when I was wondering why certain components didn't work and the fuses looked right or seemed fiddly. It's when I removed the fuse box from the bulkhead, just unscrewed it, and looked on the back of the fuse box that I found all the copper contacts had corroded in back. And that corrosion breaks your ground or breaks the continuity, and therefore, obviously, you're not getting a full current across. It's very easy to clean off and to put it right back in. But it's just not to be fooled by that. You just think that your problem is the fuse box. It just may be that it's the copper connections on the backside that are hidden from view.
Those who have Series 3s don't have that problem because the fuse box is inside.
Where there's never any water.
Right, correct. Well, I will tell you, it's not going to puddle up on the bottom side of the steering column very much.
Never any water as long as you don't follow me.
So you keep yours inside all the time.
However, with the Series 3, you have twice as many fuses to contend with.
That's true. It's not really a bad thing.
No, but you know, you have twice as many things to diagnose.
Definitely.
It's a start. I like a more sensible number of fuses, like about 6 or 8, depending on the vehicle. But I think originality is a nice thing if you're building a museum piece. But if you want a series truck that you can count on, I think it makes sense to add a sensible fuse box and a bank of relays.
Agreed.
And I would definitely say that if you're adding any kind of accessories, to run that and fuse it entirely separately of the stock wiring.
Unless you're building,
not worth risking your stock wiring.
If you're building your own system and you're rewiring the truck and you're putting in a fuse panel, if you plan ahead a little bit, you can allow yourself the fuses right there.
Agreed. But yeah, if you intend to add a number of accessories, but want to keep your wiring harness fairly standard, I would highly suggest that accessories go on separate fuses and a separate system.
Yeah, I actually ran a separate wiring system for the lights on my ambulance. I ran a large heavy conductor wire from the battery to a bank of relays, and then I used the factory wiring just to trigger those relays. So it's like a separate harness.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's a good way of doing it.
And on that note, I think that's the Heritage segment for this month. Is that right?
That is.
Thank you, Morgan. Appreciate it.
Of course, if people have questions about things we've discussed, they're welcome to write in, and then we can respond to them.
Absolutely.
Please do.
Yes, absolutely. Maybe we'll have you join the show.
I'm going to go home and take pictures of my Series 3 with no wiring.
a blank slate.
Yeah, something
like that.
Mine's
the same state right now.
Well, before we go, I had tweeted earlier today, and we actually we had a listener respond, and I just thought, why not? We have an opportunity to respond to Steve Homer out of the UK. He's at SMH in the Wind. So, Steve, hopefully you're a listener, and he responded to a tweet that I pushed out on our feed about the new Disco 5, and he said, and it looks like every other SUV on the road, the spirit of Land Rover has gone. I kind of agree with him. It doesn't look like, I don't know, it's not unique enough. They all look alike. So when we saw that,
they have an identity, but you have to look a lot harder for it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, when we saw that Disco Sport over the summer, it looked like every other vehicle on the road. I agree with you, Steve.
Get it out on the trail, and I'll make it unique.
Throw some mud on it and some dents. It'll look perfect.
Pennsylvania pinstripes.
I'll rub it against a tree somewhere, and it'll be unique.
There you go. Thanks, Steve, for tweeting, and we'll tweet back at you there. So that brings us to a close of the 31st edition of the Center Steer podcast. I want to thank everybody for listening to our show. And if you have a second or two, please go out to iTunes and give us a rating so we know that you're out there and you're listening. Or go to Twitter and tweet us at Center Steer, C-E-N-T-R-E. Or go out to our Facebook page and give us a like or give us a comment, say hi. And we appreciate you hearing that. Don't forget, we are part of the 4x4 Radio Network. If you're interested in other off-roading, other overlanding, or other makes, there's shows there for you. There's one on Jeeps, upcoming on Nissan. There's even ATV. And, of course, there's the 4x4 podcast by our friend of the show, Dan Cole, who's now stationed up in Alaska. So thanks again for listening. And I want to thank very much Jeff Aronson from Rovers Magazine for joining us on the show today. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you. At a ball.
Good. And hopefully everything goes well for this winter for you in Vinyl Haven.
Thanks.
All right, everybody. We'll talk to you next month on the 32nd edition of the Center Steer podcast. Have a great month. Get your Rover out there in the field, and we want to hear about it. Take care.
The Center Steer theme song, Sunset Rider by the Tritons, is available from Nivio's Music Alley. Check it out at music.nivio.com.
I'm redoing the closing because I just realized I didn't thank Jeff for joining us.
Oh, don't worry about it.
Yeah, I'm going to do it again.
You're fired,
Jeff. I'm fired.